You're listening to the Overdrive Podcast, Hour 2. Brought to you in part by Alpine Credits. Own your home and need a loan? With Alpine Credits, homeowners get approved.
Shaquem Griffin and his father, Terry Griffin. Shaquem's obviously part of the Seattle Seahawks.
Have you
seen him? One of the great stories. Oh, I'm a Dallas Cowboys fan. I saw him. I saw him light up Tavon Austin on the weekend.
Like, you're thinking to yourself, tackling in the NFL has become kind of an art with all the things you can.
And a mystery.
Yeah, with all the things you can and can't do. Now think of it without a hand.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a hand. He has one hand.
Yeah. So for those that know his story, and we'll get into it at 5:30 when he joins us, he had his left hand amputated when he was 4. Obviously, you can imagine all the "no, you can't be part of this team" messages that he got. Played for the University of Central Florida, which was the team that, quote unquote, was the national championship team last year. But was great there, drafted in the 5th round. And not only is part of a team, he's playing for the team.
Well, Seattle does things different than most NFL teams. They've brought in people you wouldn't think they'd bring in. They've drafted people you wouldn't think they'd draft. And sometimes I don't know if Pete Carroll does it because he wants to be different than everybody else. But when you see a guy who's drafted and he doesn't have a hand, and then he's starting week one as a rookie, and I'm thinking, this is the most unusual thing almost I've ever seen.
Yeah.
We saw Jim Abbott, right? We saw Jim Abbott pitch with one arm.
And I think this is, not to take anything away from Jim Abbott, I would think that it's tougher to play football with one hand given his position.
Yeah, it's hard to sort of compare one to another to another, but I'm just astounded by what the human capacity always is.
And he's playing with his brother Shaquille, and they're doing all these great commercials with Gillette just about his road. So we'll talk about that a little bit more at 5:30. Scott Van Pelt's going to join us at 5 o'clock. I'm going to assume you were doing the same thing I was doing on Sunday. And I was watching Tiger Woods.
I think I may be the only person on the planet who wasn't watching Tiger Woods. I'm dialed into the NFL on Sundays.
Okay,
house, we're dialed into the NFL on Sundays.
But you're bouncing back and forth.
Yeah, and so I, you know, you've got the one click movement on your converter. So you can go from the channel you're watching to whatever the other channel is, and I was just going from one game to another game.
You're rubbing your eyes looking at that score with the Bills and the Vikings.
And then this is more the 4 o'clock game, and my oldest son is a huge Seahawks guy, and so you can't turn the television while the Seahawks are on. And
I wanted to as a Cowboys fan.
Everybody's talking about the historical nature of this day and the win and everything, and I understand all of it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see a minute of it.
Well, you saw highlights.
I saw the highlights. Yeah, but you know, you don't ever get, you can watch highlights, but it isn't the same as watching it as it's occurring.
When you were watching the highlights, and on 18, the crowd that followed him, like, I'm obviously too young to know what it was like in the moment, but I've seen the footage of Arnold Palmer and Arnie's Army and watching some of those documentaries, and he was the first guy that made, you know, he was a part of really the big business of golf that started, and it was because of those fans, and it was you don't see that very often in sports.
No, I mean, there are very few athletes who are bigger than their games.
Yeah.
They have come across, you know, everyone, Federer is one of them, but they come across only so often, and people always say, who are you a fan of? I'm a fan of excellence, and I'm a fan of great stories and great storytelling.
Right.
And so when you get to see Federer at his best, or Tiger at his best, or Serena at her best, or whoever it happens to be, whether it's Bobby Orr or Gretzky, and now it's Sidney and McDavid, and you go from sport to sport with LeBron and Michael, and it's funny how many of these people are one-named athletes, you know, Tiger in this case. But that's those people, it's like hearing Sinatra sing. Like, they sound different. They look different. They do their jobs differently.
They draw you in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that's why when Tiger doesn't win, he's still the story.
Yeah.
Most of those weeks. And that's why the networks stay on him so much.
And think of all the hardcore Tiger fans, but also all those who hated Tiger. And maybe still hate Tiger. I feel like the image has softened up a bit because he's been a broken down man. But people that would cheer against him. But you know what? They watched. They had to watch.
He's the greatest we've ever seen, and then he has the greatest fall we've ever seen.
And a different kind of fall.
Yeah,
too,
fall. Right? Both
as a human being?
Human being, game, profession, personal life, everything. Completely, it's Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall and apparently couldn't be put back together again. Mm-hmm. Except, what is he now? He's put back together again.
And you know, you could argue the most feared golfer in the world. And because he had that sort of stigma to him that he beat you just by showing up to the golf course. Now, this is his first victory since 2013. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. But he's also played in a very tough era of golf. Like, there hasn't been a guy as good as Dustin Johnson and Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas. As good as those guys have been, no one's been able to kind of take hold of the tour anywhere close to how Tiger did.
Well, I was really fortunate to watch Mike Tyson when he was the most feared heavyweight in the world. And when he was the most feared heavyweight in the world, you'd watch his opponent walking up the stairs to go into the ring. And I remember I was at the Michael Spinks fight, and you're watching the guy go up the stairs, and you could see in his face, he doesn't want to be here. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to fight. And one after the other, Tyson knocked these guys until somebody actually fought back.
Yeah.
And then they realized that he was vulnerable. And it's kind of the same with Tiger Woods. If you look at his early career wins, everybody fell by the wayside. Yes, he played brilliantly, but they all cowered at his brilliance. And so as he was doing that, and then suddenly, like Tyson in that, after the Buster Douglas fight, suddenly he's vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly people can play with him. Suddenly they can beat him. And suddenly on Sunday, he's not crushing everybody, and they're not cowering. Except on Sunday, they were.
Yeah.
And on Sunday, they did fall apart while he was in his position, other than not winning the FedEx Cup. But there are similarities. And to see that, and that's what draws us in.
And the cool thing is, he's playing again this week. Ryder Cup. He's already in France.
Which, by the way, he's historically not been good in the Ryder Cup.
No,
right?
And now there's talk about playing with Mickelson, which they played once in 2004, and it was a disaster.
And they have that big match coming up, right?
They have the big match. But now they're friends.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
I think somebody needs to take one of those chairs from ringside.
You know, you want like a WWE move.
Yeah, smash the other one over the head.
Steve Vince McMahon Simmons over here.
you got to sell the pay-per-view, right? If they're friends, you can't have good guy fighting good guy.
Well,
that doesn't work.
Before that match, they need that.
Yeah,
they need something.
You need some sneaky little thing to happen.
But here's a comment that you won't hear covering the NHL over the next 8 months. He was asked who's on the Mount Rushmore of golf. And he put a lot of thought into it, as you can see in the answer. I'm sure he's obviously thought about this in the past. And he said, you know, Sam Snead, Bobby Jones, Jack Nicklaus, and me. And like a hockey, like Connor McDavid was asked about being number one. And he was like, nah, Sidney Crosby. And they're like, okay. Well, okay, what about in like 5-10 years? And he's like, well, I'm not going to say me. Like, why? Say you. You're allowed to say you.
Because the culture says,
I know.
I'm not allowed to do that unless I'm PK Subban or Jeremy Roenick.
Or
Brett Hull.
Yeah.
You know, that's the list.
But there's a difference between having that confidence, that arrogance, but it, you know, and in golf it's different because it's an individual sport. You can still be a good team player. It's a balance that it's very tough in hockey.
I look forward to the day that Connor McDavid starts showing a little more of what I know his personality to be.
But what do you know?
Instead of being the aw shucks, you know,
put out some cliches.
Put out a couple of cliches. Don't make eye contact. Look like you're really uncomfortable, and then hopefully.
Who's the Connor McDavid that you know?
He's funny. He has a personality. He has an ego. He knows how good he is. He knows how hard he works. I'd like to once in a while sort of see that side of him.
Wonder what it would take. Like, does it take a cup? Does it take?
I was going to say it might take a couple of drinks.
That's probably not going to happen.
I'm kidding. He's only 21, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
legal now.
He's legal.
Yeah.
He's been legal for a while in Alberta.
Yeah, but not in the States.
Not in the States.
Now, this will be the first season where he's legal in the States.
Watch out, everyone.
I guess the second half. Is he a January kid?
Yeah, he's got an early birthday, doesn't he?
Yeah, something like that. But I'd like to see that. And you know who's starting to show a little of that? Two guys here in Toronto. Auston Matthews, mm-hmm. Mitch Marner. I'm seeing a change in both of those guys. They're growing into themselves.
And I always saw it with Mitch Marner, like that it would be there and whether it's going to come out. Auston Matthews, I wasn't 100% sure. Maybe because he didn't play in the OHL, you didn't see him enough. growing up into being an NHL player.
When they sign their deals, I'd be curious to see, when they sign their deals, the years that follow, will they become more personalities? Will they become more confident kids? And I've seen a huge change in Marner from, this is his third year, from the time he got here to the time now. And you look at him and you know, you can see the growth already, and it's just starting.
And we've seen, obviously, Tiger Woods grow a lot as a person, as a player. And Scott Van Pelt from ESPN joins us now. He's our Subaru Golf Insider. This Golf Insider brought to you by Subaru. Right now is the perfect time to fall for a Subaru. Visit your local Ontario Subaru dealer for great rates from 0.5%. Scott, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me in to talk some golf.
Well, great timing to talk about golf right now. And I don't know if I usually say that on September 25th, but what an event on the weekend. What a performance. What a scene on 18, seeing the crowd there. Loved the interview that you conducted with him just moments after winning that tournament. And I guess, on a personal level, because you know him so well and you communicate with him so often, what was your experience like just watching sort of the king get back on the throne?
It was. He used the word surreal, and I felt similarly. It's hard to describe because I met him in 1995. I'm at the Golf Channel. He's a freshman at Stanford, and we met at the NCAA Championships in Columbus, Ohio. And the following year, he wins the U.S. Amateur in Oregon at a course called Pumpkin Ridge. And the following year, he wins the Masters in '97. And then the following spring in '98, he sat down with me and we did this big long interview about that. And in many ways, that launched my career. And he's joked with me many, many, many times since that if not for him, there would be no me. And it's entirely true. My career was spawned because of the access and interviews that I had with Tiger through the years. And for many years, from 2000 through whatever, there was just, we took him for granted because he was just the best in the world and he won all the time, blah, blah, blah. And obviously he's been through a ton and some of it is self-inflicted. Some of it's his back gives out on him, this, that, and the other thing. And now he's a 42-year-old guy with a fused back and a bald spot who's been through some stuff. And a lot of people thought this was never going to happen again. And so I watched him win, and I watched him win through the eyes of the golf fan that was happy to see him win. And then I also see him through the eyes of a guy that's known him for more than 20 years. And this is really odd to say out loud because it sounds pretentious, but I was just happy for my friend. And at some point you realize, well, that's what we became over the years. You became professionally friendly with this man. Who didn't. And so I make zero apologies for the fact that I felt real happiness and real joy for my friend winning again. And the outpouring of adulation from people that you saw in Atlanta was unlike anything I've ever seen before. And I've been at this for a while. So it was, I know that's a long answer, but there's a lot to unpack here for that for me.
So we can say you're Cosell to his Ali of a different generation.
With respect to the late, great Howard Cosell, I hope I haven't been seen like him. I'm not an instigator or an agitator as such, but I know him well.
I'm talking more about the relationship, really, because those two became famous beside each other, so to speak.
And that's interesting. And I mean, look, Ali, in the same way that Ali is a global name and is recognized just his image, Tiger certainly has been that. Look, he's been far from perfect, but I think that's what makes him so much more relatable now. And I've said this on a number of occasions in spots like these where it's more thinking out loud, but I find that a guy who's got scar tissue and been through some stuff and has been divorced and has had his battles with sobriety or whatever is far more relatable than a 25-year-old who just wins every golf tournament he plays and doesn't make a misstep. There's nothing relatable about that. There's plenty that's relatable about human frailty and whatever. But ultimately, people just wanted to see him be great again, and they did. And so for us to talk on Sunday night was it made me really reflective. And now that I'm done that, mm-hmm. Now I think you see the old Tiger back in an instant when he, at his press conference at the Ryder Cup in France, talked about these young guys who said they wanted a chance to battle him. And he said, well, now you got it. And it's like, boys, you're about to find out. And if he's healthy, and he can go for a while. Like, it's about to really get fun out there.
And yeah, and that, could there be something better for golf than that?
No.
Right now, it's the Tiger versus the field, and that field, and maybe you disagree with me, but that field seems so much better than it did 10, 15 years ago when Tiger was dominating.
Sure, because these are the Frankenstein guys that came out of the lab that he created. They look like that, who are athletes that are you know, that get in the gym, that value the idea of being. Rory McIlroy has totally changed his body. He's tiny. He hits it farther than anybody. All these guys are a generation spawned from following and wanting to follow in Tiger's footsteps. And so now if the health and the mind and the body allow him to do what he's done this year and get out there in the arena for, say, 5 years and trade punches with Rory and Spieth and Thomas and Day and Koepka and Dustin Johnson and on, well, then it's a blast. I mean, look, you guys see the ratings, and I don't know if it's particularly interesting, but it is to me because I'm in television. I mean, the ratings are up like 180% without, and he's a singular tide that lifts all boats in that sport, and there's nothing else like it in American sport. Nothing.
Yeah.
No single person represents a greater ratings move. He doesn't move the needle. He is the needle. He is the needle.
And we've been waiting. All those guys that you mentioned, we've been waiting for them to move things. ESPN Scott Van Pelt joining us here on Overdrive.
See, when I look at what happened Sunday and I look at everything that he's gone through from the great times to the terrible ones, is it possible that Sunday is a one-off, or is Tiger Woods now ready to challenge for a major?
Well, he led on Sunday at the Open on the back nine on Sunday, and he was right there with a chance to win the PGA, but he couldn't, Brooks Koepka never wobbled. So I'd say that a guy that a year ago wasn't ranked in the top 100 players on earth, a year later, led on Sunday at the Open and was a shot back on Sunday on the back nine at the PGA. So I certainly believe that he could. It's an interesting question because there's a bit of in me that wonders how much of this climb back to the top of the mountain was to put the flag in the ground one more time and look at that view. And did that represent the end of it? But knowing him as I do, I think that's base camp. You know, now he's got his sights set on the next hill, and that certainly would be a major. The one thing I'd say, that the caveat is that it's really difficult to win those, and you need many things to go right, and he isn't the only guy that enters with chances to win, which isn't to say in 2000 he was the only one, but he was such a singular presence and so many guys were defeated before it started. It's not that way now because these guys haven't dealt with him. They haven't had to compete with him. Now they will, and that'll be a lot of fun. But, you know, a major is, you know, based on what we saw this summer, that's certainly in his wheelhouse. He would be in the discussion to do it.
Well, I think one guy who thinks that Tiger can win a major apparently is Phil Mickelson, who tweeted today, "I just played with Tiger, and it's the best I've seen him swing the club. It's so on plane and solid. I'll be asking for a shot aside for our Thanksgiving match. I doubt I'll get it, though." What's going
on? That's order your pay-per-view now, by the way.
Yeah, but also,
next line there.
What's with this bromance? Like the world that I come from, they don't like each other.
Well, I tell you, it's amazing to see, because I'll promise you that not that long ago, none of this was you know, they didn't, not only were they didn't like each other, were they, you know, a bromance, they couldn't stand each other. And again, I think it speaks to perspective and growth. In the same way that Tiger used to kind of keep the crowd's adulations at arm's length, that, you know, the byproduct of fame was frankly a pain in the ass, just all of the attention. Now he taps into that love and allows those people to lift him. He told me Sunday night on our interview that they've, without question, those folks, they didn't. And Tiger understands Phil in a different way. Now they're older. They're fathers. He's in a different place in life than he was when he was just a tunnel vision 25-year-old. And so I think they recognize we've got way more in common than we have different. They're the old guys in the room at the Ryder Cup now, and these young guys feed off of the stories and the experiences. And if you'd have told me that Tiger and Phil would be buddy-buddy at the end of their career, I'd have told you you were out of your mind. Like, there was no chance. I don't mean like a little. I mean no chance.
It was like watching.
The fact that it's happened is amazing.
It's like watching Jimmy Connors at the end of his career being liked by people. Like,
yeah, right?
The people at the U.S. Open. He became a hero at the end of his career.
Yeah. But it's different in the sense that, like, Tiger was always the most popular guy.
Right.
But even the most hardened people that, for whatever reason, got sick of Tiger, and there's certainly people that did, like, you'd have to be a pretty hardened soul to have not watched Sunday and at least been moved by how many other people were moved. And I'm sure not everybody will be, because, I mean, people are going to, and I can hear them now saying, he did this and he did that. Yeah, you're right. He screwed up his marriage and he had pills or whatever. And guess what? None of that had anything to do with you. The issues he had with himself and with his wife. And they had nothing to do with you. But if it bums you out, then that's fine. You can bum you out. But Tiger was always the most popular guy. Always.
And
it's just now. It's now there are far fewer detractors. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. I was just going to say, and it'll be interesting to see how that, you know, plays on, whether or not they play with each other or not during the Ryder Cup, which kicks off.
I think they're going to.
You think so?
I think so, and I mean, it didn't work before. I mean, Hal Sutton put them out together, and it was an absolute disaster because they hated each other. But now that they're buddies, who knows? I mean, the American side's got a lot of talent, but those, you know, beware the home underdog in the Ryder Cup. It's always a scary proposition.
Which kicks off on Friday on TSN. Just very quickly, want to get your thoughts on, it was a big day for the Raptors yesterday. Kawhi Leonard actually was...
He spoke.
Yeah, he spoke.
Very exciting.
He was there and... flesh and bones and everything. Just from your perspective, as you cover things from south of the border, what are you looking for in terms of what Kawhi Leonard is like today compared to what he's like at the end of the season?
Gentlemen, without a close second, his saga last year with San Antonio is the strangest story of the year. Whatever happened there, I will never know. Whatever advice he got from his camp was, in my opinion, not particularly useful. He's there now, and he's an incredibly talented player, presuming he's healthy enough to play. Last year, there was great debate about, you know, whether he was or wasn't. His team said he was. He obviously felt otherwise. I don't have an answer because I don't know what to say other than, I just hope he plays, and beyond that, I don't know what make of it, because he says so little. So, I mean, we got a great kick out of just that unusual chuckle. I was just happy to see him smile.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was just kind of like everyone's looking around like, whoa, that's sort of an odd delivery of that laugh there, huh? And he's the biggest question mark in American sports to me, and now... you know, global sports, because obviously he's there in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great city and it's a good organization. Will he fall in love? Like, could it be a Paul George? I have no idea. I would have never thought George would have stayed in OKC, and he did. So maybe, but I mean, everybody just assumed that he's had his sights set on the West Coast and that that's where he'd land next year. Who the hell knows, man? It is such a bizarre, bizarre saga that we've seen.
We all sort of knew that the Raptors in the last couple of years would always be, you know, close to, you know, a 50-55, maybe even a 60-win team. This could go in five or six different directions, and they could come back down to earth a little bit in the regular season, but be a better playoff team, and that's what's going to make things so interesting.
But you guys have been so good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the curse, isn't it? You're really good in the regular season, then it falls apart in the playoffs, and then you want to blow it up. And I guess at some point you have to, and that's what this is. But who knows? We'll see if he sticks around.
I look forward to the first day he has to go out and shovel the driveway. That's the one I want to get film of.
Yeah, he does not. I can assure you of that.
Yeah, he's got a downtown condo right by the arena.
There you go.
Scott, excellent job with the Tiger Woods interview. You're one of the best in the business, and always great to have you here on the show.
That's really, really kind, and I appreciate you putting up with my long-winded answers. But this is a topic that I really find interesting, so I was happy to get a chance to visit with you boys. Thanks for having me.
As long as they're good answers, we're okay with the long-winded ones.
I understand.
Awesome stuff. Scott Van Pelt from ESPN covering Tiger Woods winning the Tour Championship and Kawhi Leonard in Toronto.
He had mentioned that he saw him play college golf, and that's where the relationship started. I got fortunate. I don't do much golf. Historically, but I got sent to the Greater Milwaukee Open, Tiger Woods' first professional tournament. I would love to tell you the year, but I don't remember it.
Nice.
But I remember he hit his first drive on hole one, and it was about 340. And in those days, nobody was hitting 340. And the guy, one of the marshals, put a marker down. And I said, "What's that?" He says, "I'm just keeping it there to show everyone this is where Tiger Woods hit his first drive."
Wow.
So he hadn't spent more than a minute on the PGA Tour, and he was already famous.
It's funny just seeing, you know, the evolution of him physically, the evolution of him off the court, how his game has changed psychologically.
He was broken. He was a broken man.
He was, remember, in the middle of the 2010 Olympics, his press conference, stopped all, broadcasting from Vancouver so we could see that. Like, it's, think of how many athletes could do that.
It was, by the way, Greater Milwaukee Open, 1996.
Yeah, I thought so.
I did a fantasy draft from the press room for my NFL season on the phone.
The big news coming this afternoon, Roberto Osuna, the former closer of the Toronto Blue Jays, has agreed to a peace bond. There is no prospect of conviction. The alleged victim, who is the mother of his three-year-old child, did not want to travel from Mexico City to Toronto to testify. And essentially, the peace bond is good behavior for a year, and he is not guilty. So now,
I think you need to be careful with the use of the word "not guilty."
Well, okay,
he's not pleaded guilty or been found guilty. They found a way to basically plea bargain this, which is the best way you can put it. But I've been to many cases where you can tell by the case that someone is not innocent, but by the law, they have not been found guilty. And so in this case, as the prosecutor said, we could not proceed with any hopes of getting a conviction because the victim in this case has got returned to Mexico and has refused to come here to testify or be part of this. So they had no witness and they had nobody to put up in this case. Sometimes you can try a case without, but it's pretty difficult to get a conviction under those circumstances. And so they decided that this was the best way to proceed. But to say not guilty is to possibly be inaccurate.
Yeah. His alleged actions cost him 75 games for a suspension, which Major League Baseball, that was historic, and they're not going to do that if there's not something there. But the Astros, they probably went into the situation, like they did their due diligence, but they were probably sweating this a little bit, that they might have lost him to another suspension if something came up or to charges.
So the Blue Jays made a decision, and the decision was, knowing as much of the facts as they can possibly know, they know what baseball knows, they know what they were able to come up with on their own, and they know what they've talking to the people involved. They came up, their solution was, we don't want him here anymore. And so they traded him. And Ken Giles has actually done a nice job for the Blue Jays since he's been here as a closer. But they made a decision to get 50 cents on the dollar, or maybe a little bit more than that, in exchange for Osuna. Now, had they known a month ago that this thing would go away in a month, I'm wondering if their decision might have been different, or if they're very comfortable with making that decision knowing what it is they know.
And also the timing of things as well. With the team out of contention. Like if they were, say they were 5 or 6 games better than they were at that time, and they got a hint of that, I think the baseball mind oversees the morality of it, right? Because there's a lot of people that, on a moral standpoint, don't care if he's guilty or innocent. He shouldn't be part of our team. And I respect that.
See, I don't respect that.
I don't respect
anyone who strikes a woman under any
circumstances. That's what I'm saying, yeah. So I'm saying, no, but I respect the fact that a team wouldn't want him regardless.
Yeah, I agree. I was misunderstanding your point. My thing with Osuna here, you have to look at so many different layers of this. Think of the Blue Jay organization. What haven't they done in about a 10-year period? Develop very many players. And of most of the ones they developed, they historically traded the Noah Syndergaards or others away. Roberto Osuna was one of the real success stories of the Blue Jays organization. He was pitching in the majors at 20. He was closing games in his first season. Through 4 years, he's been, I'm not going to say he's been perfect, but he's been very, very good. And so to move, those are one of those guys you build franchises around from a baseball point of view. Then you get to the real life point of view. and things aren't going the way you want them to, and you have problems prior to this happening, mm-hmm. and prior problems that they were aware of personality-wise, and problems that he had had with more than one woman, and so you have all those things, and then you have this happen, and it there isn't a right answer or a wrong answer here, mm-hmm. and it's a really complicated, difficult thing to try and deal with and make sense with, but when you have, especially when it's a player. Like, it's the old story. If three guys on a team get in trouble, one guy's a great player and the other two aren't. The other two are
right.
dished off without even thought.
And they'll find a way to keep that third guy.
Yeah, and in this case, I guess they looked at it and they thought we're going to find a way, and they decided in the end not to find a way. And they didn't really ever explain themselves in any way. It was the Astros that had to explain themselves for picking him up.
Mm-hmm.
And they may continue to have to explain themselves as they go through the playoffs, even though this is now, the court part of it is now over.
Well, when the playoffs enter when baseball enters the postseason, it becomes much more of a national story, because baseball, because there's so many teams, so many games, it becomes very regionalized. You could like an American League team and not pay attention to the National League or vice versa. All of a sudden, your team is playing that team, and it's, what's this guy's story? And, oh my, he's pitching?
Well, a lot of people, because the Houston Astros have had, this is how you are to be an Astro.
Mm-hmm.
They've had very strict policy internally mm-hmm. about what their players should be, need to be, and what they want them to be. And so when they went against that, so to speak, all in the form of, we got to get back to the World Series, a lot of people looked at them negatively. And a lot of major U.S. baseball columnists ripped at the Houston Astros, saying, wait a minute, on the one hand, you're saying this, on the other hand, you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And one doesn't connect with the other. And I'm curious to see, now that the case has been settled one way or the other, you can be dissatisfied with how it's settled, but Often court cases end that way.
And for the Houston Astros, he continues to pitch, and he'll continue to pitch tonight. Well, he might pitch tonight as the Blue Jays and the Astros continue their series. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Shaquem Griffin and his father, Terry Griffin, to talk about his long journey to becoming an NFL player despite all the obstacles that he faced throughout his football career. This has been a two-man show for almost 2 hours, and now it becomes a five-man show because we're going to welcome in not one, not two, but three great guests. We've been looking forward to telling this story. We welcome into Overdrive Shaquem Griffin, Terry Griffin, and Shaquille Griffin. Gentlemen, how are you?
Great.
Oh, good. Thank you for having us today.
Never know how that's going to go when you ask three people how they're doing, but you guys timed that perfectly. And we brought everyone in because there's this great story about your family that you're telling with Gillette. And, Gillette understands your best never comes easy. And that's a great way of talking about Shaquem Griffin's NFL career, because you've become the league's first one-handed player, and you did so with the help of your brother and your father, Terry, to overcome all these obstacles, and just an incredible amount of determination to get here. And I guess I'll start with you, Terry. As a father, how did you help your son overcome something that probably most people said would never happen?
Just constantly, trying to instill hard work. Hard work's going to pay off. Hard work's going to pay off. You want to be better than that next guy. So, you got to do these push-ups. You got to do these sit-ups. You got to run. Every edge that we can get, we're going to take it.
So, Shaquem, at any level, did you ever look and say, I can't play football anymore?
No.
It's a great answer.
And let me expand on that, then. Coaches, parents, friends, anything. Did anybody say, why are you doing this?
That happened at every stage of my life, to be honest, from Little League to high school to college. And I'm pretty sure there's got a lot more doubters now. And, my whole point is, I didn't want nobody opinion or anybody who say so dictated what I was going to do on or off the field. I took the initiative upon myself to make sure that I push myself as hard as possible to make sure I get everything I wanted. And that's me playing ball. I didn't want to stop playing ball because somebody else said so. You know, I don't think, you know, it shouldn't work like that. You know, you do what you put your mind to and you work for anything that you want out of life.
So I can see you going to training camp, and I can see you maybe making the NFL as a rookie. But starting week one, how amazing was that?
I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I was beside my brother again, and I mean, it felt good to be out there. I mean, you know, the biggest stage there is, and you out there with your brother right, side by side, making tackles together. I mean, that was the best thing. That was a moment that I would last forever.
Yeah, well, Shaquille, you're a big part of this as well, and it just, you know, it happens, and it really puts a bow on the whole story that he gets drafted by the team that you're on, the Seattle Seahawks. How have you contributed to that transition? Because it's one thing to be a star at the college level. We have seen very few players be able to carry that into the NFL and to be able to do it so quickly.
Well, the main thing I did was just tell them everything I went through. I feel like the easiest part is telling someone, you know, early what they might, you know, what situation they might be put in or scenario. And once it happened, you know what to do. You know exactly what to do in those type of situations. So I feel like my main thing was to give him all the knowledge that I learned, you know, from the vets from my first year. So his first year could be a lot easier, you know, of course, than mine. And I feel like that's the biggest thing I've been doing is just trying to give him everything that I know, you know, early. So it just be easier and a lot more simple for him to go through. I feel like that's the main thing I've been doing.
So when Shaquem is coming to camp after the draft, Shaquille, are your teammates asking you questions? How's this going to work? How's he going to play? The kind of things that I guess fans are thinking at the same time.
No, not one player, you know, asked me a question like that or, you know, was wondering how it was going to work. You know, everybody accepted him with open arms and was ready to see him play. And everybody knew what type of baller he was already. So they were just excited to see it for themselves. And they was glad for him to be a part of this organization and this team. So I feel like everybody was just, you know, as excited as I was to see him actually run around the field, you know, with us for the first time. So everybody opened him, you know, had open arms and accepted him and, you know, loved him the same way I did when he got here.
Joined by Seattle Seahawks, Shaquem Griffin, his brother Shaquille, and also their father, Terry Griffin. They've been doing these great kind of video, these commercials with Gillette that are just so inspiring. And, you know, Shaquem, your story's been told now for a couple of years as a star for the University of Central Florida. Your left hand amputated when you were four. You're drafted in the fifth round. And then here you are playing America's team on the weekend, the Dallas Cowboys. And who lights up Tavon Austin on special teams but you? And I want to know who's more jacked up when you tackled him. You, Pete Carroll, who was going nuts, or your brother Shaquille?
That's a hard one, man. Pete he'd be turned up when we make plays. But, you know, I got to give it to my brother. I mean, ain't nobody going to bring the excitement how he brings it. And so I got to give it to my brother, but Pete right behind him.
Dad, I got to ask you this question. If it wasn't Pete Carroll, do you think another coach in the NFL would have taken a shot at Shaquem?
I'm pretty sure it was someone out there. If they looked at his, you know, his film, his numbers, you know, he had everything that they was asking for. It's just giving him the shot, and that's all I ever asked. Just give him a shot, and he can show you the rest.
Well, and it's funny that we've gone through, 3 weeks of the NFL season, we're already seeing it, and it takes rookies usually seasons to kind of get used to that level of play. And Shaquem, I'm wondering, what is the dialogue like on the field? You're dealing with opponents. Part of the game is trash talking, getting in your opponent's head. How are your opponents approaching you, making history on the field, but also they look at you and they maybe see there's a disability there?
I mean, I ain't really had nobody talk trash to me yet. I be putting awkward situations now in the game. It's different from college. You know, everybody come up with like, man, you so motivational, man. Keep doing your thing. So it's not trash talking. So I don't really know what to say when somebody say that to me. So I be like, I just say thank you, you know. You can't trash nobody when they say, you know, you motivational. Mm-hmm. You motivational. It's hard to say that when a player come up and say that. Be in the middle of a play and say, man, you so motivational, man.
It kind of throws you off, doesn't it?
It's an honor to play against you. How you talk trash to that?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah, I like you too, man.
Yes.
So you're through 3 weeks now. I'm sure going to camp, you couldn't have known, am I going to make the team? Am I not going to make the team? Am I going to play? Am I going to start? Here you are 3 weeks in. Give me a synopsis 3 weeks in about how this has felt for you.
Man, I don't know. I haven't really even got a chance to really think about it. Everything been moving so fast, but, you know, man, I'm just extremely blessed. I'm happy that I'm in the situation that I'm in. Sometimes it feels surreal, and I feel like I be dreaming sometimes, but it's happening. I mean, you know, I already started the film study for this week, and we gotta get ready for this week's game, and it's crazy. It's going to be game four already.
And how important is it for you to be an example for others?
I mean, it's extremely important. You know, I never want to, you know, be caught of not being myself. I mean, I always want everybody to see who I am and always see who I am. And that's on and off the field. So, you know, whatever I'm starting, whatever I created, I want to keep it going.
Well, Shakeem, you talked about thinking. Are you able to think in Seattle with that crowd when things are going well? Because it seemed pretty loud on TV on Sunday.
I mean, you'll be surprised. It's kind of probably easy to think to yourself when it's that loud. You can't hear nobody else.
You just block everyone else out. See, I can hear Shaquille laughing because he knows from experience.
And
yeah, I mean, I'm always laughing.
And Dad, before letting you go, how many pieces of Seahawk garb, shirts, jerseys, jackets, hats, do you own now?
Oh, a lot. But my wife, you can triple that number.
Yeah. Isn't that always the way?
Yes.
Well, you better not be paying full price for that garb. Guys, it's so great to have you on the show. Shakeem, obviously inspiring to so many, and love these spots that you're doing with Gillette. They're online right now. It tells your story, but it also tells your story through the eyes of your father and your brother. So it's been great watching that. And to everyone, good luck against Arizona this weekend.
Thank you so much.
There's Shakeem, Shaquille, and Terry Griffin. Shakeem, the first player in league history to play with just one hand.
And when you watch him, you're thinking, how do you tackle? Like, how do you tackle if you can't grab?
Well, a lot of players are asking that question, but from a different reason, yes.
He's got a wrap.
Well, but
he's got to do the things that we were taught when we were little guys to play.
Well, but think about his father was talking about, you know, you got to do the work. You got to do the push-ups. How do you do a push-up with one hand? You know, well, like in the video you're showing, he's
a
got
a fist, I guess.
He's got it on a weight, yeah, to kind of balance it out. It's just, think of all the things that we take for granted just in life, and then now try to be an elite athlete and try to do, because it's all about, you know, me competing against you, Steve, and trying to do the same. And you did 10 pull-ups, I got to do 12 pull-ups now to, you know, keep pace with you.
Yeah, but if you're in the flat and the quarterback makes a bad pass, you're expected to pick it off. Mm-hmm. And go. And he can do that. And it's crazy.
Anyways, great story. Great to have them on the show. Shakeem Griffin and the Seattle Seahawks defeating the Dallas Cowboys on the weekend. They'll face the Arizona Cardinals on the weekend.